Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. You're listening to the Iron Fist and Velvet Glove podcast. We're up to episode 70. It's the 9th of November, 2016. I'm not sure what dimension we're in. I feel we've slipped through a portal or something like that because, well, Scott, you're with me. Scott, a.k.a. the Velvet Glove. It's been an interesting day.
It's a day that beggars belief. I cannot understand what was going through the heads of millions of Americans. You know, Hillary was not the best candidate for sure, but she was light years ahead of Donald Trump. You know, it's absolutely astounding that that man has won the prize. I am absolutely flabbergasted. I don't often find myself lost for words, but I am. I mean, this is my second beer tonight. So. Yeah, right.
It goes to show, Scott, that rational argument has no place in politics anymore. Like, it's completely gone. Yeah. It's all about identity politics, and there is no need to present a coherent, logical set of policies at all. Like, he's totally debunked the idea of great policies. And he's simply painted a picture to pick up some identity groups. And they don't care what he has said, provided they think he's for their group. And that's it. That's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably it for sure. But, you know, it's
I've said it before, but The three R's explain Donald Trump. Race, religion, and redneck. And as we've seen from statistics of voting patterns in the US, race is number one. So black people vote for black candidates, white people vote for white candidates. In this case, we didn't have a black candidate, but his comments about Latinos especially made it clear he wasn't a fan of coloured people. And for the racist white people in America, they've absolutely despised having Barack Obama as their president, so they've been keen to change that. Religion, he said he was religious and that he, you know, his favourite book was the Bible. Nobody in their right mind would believe him, but he said he was, and he appeared to be more so than Hillary Clinton and more ready to, you know, possibly change abortion laws. So, oh, for goodness sake, Scott, what sort of... He could potentially nominate, you know, three Supreme Court judges. I mean, what will happen in the Supreme Court of America by the time he's finished with them? But the crucial one, the crucial...
You could end up seeing gay marriage being reversed.
Anything's possible. But the crucial one that has got Trump over the line was the third R, was redneck, Scott.
Yeah.
And redneck, you know, it's a good old boys sitting on the porch, whittling away with the pickup truck in the background, who are struggling to get a job, pro-gun, anti-elite, rural quite often. And, you know, a lot of the reports coming out have shown that those people don't traditionally vote, and this time they did. Like, Donald Trump motivated a lot of rural rednecks to come out and vote. So,
There's no doubt there's that. I mean, that's for sure. I think the three R's, they've certainly come into their own in this analysis. But, you know, and me and my better half were having this conversation earlier tonight. He said that, because my initial reaction was, well, this is the Democrats' fault for selecting Hillary Clinton. And he said to me, he said, no. He says, you can't just blame them. You should be blaming the Republicans for actually selecting Donald Trump. There's fault on both sides. I think that Hillary Clinton was a flawed candidate, and I think that that with the benefit of hindsight now, I think that Bernie Sanders would have done better against Trump. I think he would have won and won comfortably. And, you know, because of his age and that sort of stuff, he probably only had one term in him, in which case he'd then hand over to Elizabeth Warren afterwards. But, I don't see why
Hillary was so bad. But Hillary's... one of her biggest problems was being female. Like, the other reports coming out from people, you know, when they speak to Trump reporters, Trump supporters, is a lot of sexist attitudes there, not wanting to vote for a woman. So...
Is that right?
Yeah. It was, you know, that's part of that redneck element as well. So a big part of it would have been, if she was exactly the same person but was a man, I reckon she would have got over the line.
Well, that's possible, yeah.
So,
I mean, you know, I personally think that, you know, I still remember Whitewater and that sort of stuff. Like, you know, there's certainly enough there to, sink the Clintons full stop. But, you know, the brouhaha over her emails, that must mean a lot more to Americans than what it does to the outside world. Because, you know, she was Secretary of State, she had her own email server, all that sort of stuff. I mean, big deal. Mm. You know, the FBI went through it all and said that they didn't have any, they didn't find anything that was worth looking at. You know, it's...
if it wasn't that issue, they would have found something.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Even without that, they would have just dreamt something up. So, you know, that was just a very big beat up over nothing. But they were going to beat something up over nothing, and that just happened to be that email was the one to go with. But
well, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Scott, what does it mean for Australia? Well, our share market's down, I think.
Well...
But
the share market is down, and you know, my better half again. He said that we'll never be able to retire now. So.
Well,
I mean, look, you know, the share market's down. What it means for Australia is the TPP is dead, unless Obama manages to get it done in his lame duck period, which
that's not going to happen.
It's well. You would imagine that the Democrats and the Republicans who are in the Congress are probably more likely to be supportive of the TPP as opposed to Donald Trump. So they may well see this as an opportunity to get it in, get it done, and move on. You know, but we'll have to wait and see there. But I would imagine if you're a betting man, you'd probably say the TPP is dead.
I'd definitely take bets on that.
Well, yeah, of course you would. Yeah. You know, it is probably dead. So, you know, the worries that we've had about, you know, what do you call them? The extrajudicial... Oh, it's on the tip of my tongue.
The clauses in the TPP, you mean?
Exactly,
the clauses.
ISDS clauses. ISDSs, yes, yep. The ISDSs. They're not going to be a problem for Australia anymore. Mm. But it is worrying. Anyway, we'll have to see what happens. I noticed this afternoon on the Drum, Bob Carr was on there, and he was saying that, in his opinion, Australia should not rethink the alliance, but should rethink investing as heavily as we do. Because we've currently got troops that are embedded with the Americans and vice versa. And he said that, given who the new commander-in-chief is going to be, that we should be removing our troops from American command. And it's kind of hard to argue with him on that.
Well, I think, you know, in recent times and even further back, we have just been such a lapdog to the US in terms of foreign policy that maybe the silver lining to all this is that we'll become more independent of US decisions.
Yes.
And instead of the US president saying jump and us asking how high, well, we might actually say, well, hang on a minute, it's Donald Trump asking this, we'd better think about it. So
exactly,
that could be something beneficial coming out of all this, where we have a more independent stance in our relationship with the US and say, big brother, this particular idea you've got isn't perhaps the best one you've ever had. We're not going along with it. So that could be an advantage, Scott.
It could be an advantage, and you know, Donald Trump has said all the right things about America being the world's police officer and that sort of stuff. He has said that he didn't want the US involved in so many wars.
Hmm.
You know, so there could be some good things coming on the horizon.
Hmm.
China, for example, is in for a rocky ride from the United States.
Is it? Like,
well, he hasn't. He's never said anything positive about the Chinese.
Yeah, but who knows? He sounds like a guy who's saying that America doesn't have to be the world's policeman anymore, and look after yourselves, and or pay us money if you want us to help. Like, that seems to be so. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing for China, so...
Well, not necessarily a bad thing for China, mm. but China in the trade world mm. will probably end up losing out.
Mm.
You know, he's talked about a 40-odd percent tariff on Chinese goods
mm.
going into America.
We're falling into a trap here, Scott, is we're actually, mm. we're actually considering that he might do what he says he's going to do. Like... Like, this is the whole thing with Donald Trump, is he would say anything without the slightest intention of following through with it, just because...
That's true.
Yeah. At that moment, it popped into his head. Like, so we're just... You're really clutching at straws if you think you know what Donald Trump's going to do, because even he doesn't know until enters his head. So it's just going to be a complete schmozzle. It'll be very interesting to observe. But Scott...
It will be interesting to observe. We'll have to see whether or not he lasts the full term. There was even one report a couple of days ago that was a seasoned political watcher who said that Donald Trump won't even last the full term. He reckons that he'll spit the dummy partway through it all and walk out, meaning Mike Pence will take the job. Mike, is it? Anyway, Pence, his running mate, will take the job. I'm not convinced of that. I think he'll hang around, and I think he will actually probably attempt a second term, and at that point the Democrats will be back.
He's not going to spit the dummy and drop out. He's just...
No, I don't think
busted
so.
Busted a gun
no.
getting into this position, so he's
not, exactly.
He's not going anywhere. But
no, I wouldn't have thought so.
No. Scott, I was initially, prior to the extraordinary events of today, just going to add a fourth R to my three Rs on race, religion and redneck, and I was going to add a fourth R, which was Rupert, the Rupert Murdoch, because he's the other big influence in this whole thing. Like, Fox News... and Rupert Murdoch have just cultivated the redneck element in America over the last 20 years.
Mm.
And they have absolutely no respect for the truth, and they are so biased in their reporting, and it's all about attitude and yelling, and reasoned debate has nothing to do with it. And they have created Donald Trump as a kind of a Frankenstein monster, as much as anybody. And it's kind of ironic that they're perhaps not 100% happy having him now, but he's a sort of the devil spawn that they can't sort of, you know, control any longer. So article from the New Matilda giving those sorts of ideas about Rupert Murdoch being partly responsible for Donald Trump. And some of the quotes from the article are...
Dr. Frankenstein created a monster and Rupert Murdoch's people created Donald Trump,
yep.
the candidate. Mm. Once was fantasy and the other was all too real. Yep. Anyway, you know, that's how the whole thing... how it starts. Anyway, sorry, yep. I'll cut you off.
No worries. So observers and commentators have agreed that Trump and Brexit are signalling a new force, a substantial and growing number of voters who are disillusioned with the current political parties, institutions and processes. This group is beyond the traditional political processes. They have no interest in analysing and weighing arguments or the possibility that maybe here and there the opponent might have a point. This is tribal gut response stuff. Argument no longer matters and attitude is everything. Rational debate and science are sneered at and dismissed as elite. And that's the sort of breeding ground that News Corp has been, and Donald Trump's crawled out of the swamp of that sort of that sort of festering pool that they've created. And that's what we've got. Well, that's what the US has got anyway.
Well, that's what the US has got. And by extension, we also have him as well.
Mm.
You know, it's, you know, not that we're the 51st state of America, but we are pretty close, you know. So, anyway. Mm.
I've been predicting for some time, Scott, the decline of the USA as an empire, if you like. And I was sort of working on sort of the inequality in the US system, where they've just got an extreme poor now. The middle class has totally disappeared and a very small upper class left. And I was thinking that that was going to lead to some sort of civil war eventually in America. And so, yes, I've been sort of predicting a civil war decline in the USA that would happen some stage in the next 50 years. But I reckon, Scott, we could mark this day down, 9th of November, as perhaps the signalling of the end of the USA as an empire. Like, it's quite possible that this is the date. Because as an empire, you know, one of their key things has been their interest in overseas affairs. And if Donald Trump is going to do anything like what he's said, and again, you can't rely on that, but he's really sort of signalling that withdrawal from the world policeman's role. So that's a signal. And it's also a signal, Scott, of... I quickly... When I was looking at what the result was today, I was trying to sort of look at the other examples of collapses of empires and what had happened, and see if there's anything sort of similar happening with the USA as a result of this. And there was this article about the collapse of complex societies, and it was looking at the collapse of a few empires. And there's a book by Joseph A. Tainter, The Collapse of Complex Societies. And he examined various civilizations which collapsed and was trying to work out why it happened. And he basically came down to an economic argument that, he talked about, you know, civilizations as being complex societies, and he defined a collapse as being a rapid shift to a lower level of complexity. And he put it down to an economic argument. And if you think of something like the Roman Empire, where it just got increasingly bigger and more complicated, and the apparatus and infrastructure needed to support the large empire put a great strain on resources such as the farming and food and all that sort of stuff. So all very well to conquer territories, but then you have the problem of administrating those territories, and the costs involved with that start to outweigh the benefits. And in his view, that was when societies collapsed. So I'll quote a little bit here. The time comes when extra investment in more complexity and more empire generates no good at all, for the benefits are wholly swallowed up in the costs of supporting the administration, bureaucracy, and other parasites that social complexity involves. He says the Western Roman Empire failed because maintaining a far-flung empire in a hostile environment imposed excessive costs on its agricultural basis. The Maya failed because the burdens of competitive warfare between the many city-states could no longer be borne by a weakened population. And the Chaco complex, which was a Pueblo society, failed when communities found the costs of contributing to a regional network of redistribution not worth the benefit and withdrew from it. And the US has certainly been spending enormous amounts of money on overseas war that they just can't afford. Like, they've poured so much money into their defense force that it's actually weakened their domestic capabilities. And
absolutely it has, yeah.
And we're also, Scott, reaching a point, so, you know, I call them rednecks, which sounds disparaging and sometimes is, but there's genuinely a lot of unskilled people who have lost their jobs to either machinery or to unskilled workers who are overseas. Mm. And when you've, you know, the USA, for example, and us in Australia to an extent, when you're creating a more complex society and the jobs that are created are complex jobs and the simple jobs are extinguished, you've got a situation with, well, what are you going to do with the people who no longer have a job? Like, they can't all be baristas. So
no, that's right, yeah.
By creating complex civilizations, you've either got to... The money is funneling its way to the people who own the machines or the big businesses, so you've either got to funnel money back to the poor people so that they can live and spend money, or... And we've probably reached the... There's a sort of a philosophical argument that we're reaching the point where our complexity is... started to not work out to be the marginal cost isn't working out. Like, sure, we're saving money by reducing manual jobs, but we're now going to have to spend so much money in redistributing the wealth back to the people who don't have a job that we might as well have given them a job in the first place of a simple kind. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, and that's a very good argument. And that's one of the reasons that I'm still wholeheartedly in support of free trade, but that is one thing that does cause me some grief.
Yeah.
Because you have a situation, you know, submarines notwithstanding, the cost to subsidise the auto industry,
yes,
was nothing compared to what we're about to...
Yep.
Waste on submarines.
Yep.
But it was a cost that was never going away. It was a yep. cost that was recurring each year and that sort of stuff.
Yep.
But we could have maintained those 50,000 workers we had...
While they're still alive, the cost is still there. I mean,
yeah,
we're
exactly.
they're going to either have to get some money through a job or through welfare. And
exactly, yeah.
And if you're... You know, so you've got two choices. You can either say, let's get rid of the simple jobs. We'll make, we'll aim for all a complicated society and civilization. In which case, not everybody can do those jobs and there just aren't that many jobs. In which case, you've got to redistribute wealth back to those people who have missed out on a job. Or you take the opposite view and say, well... there's no point creating this complex system that wipes out a million jobs if we then have to just redistribute money back to a million people. Like, at some point, why bother? So
yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one of those arguments that's going around now. There's talk of a basic wage being paid to everyone and, you know, it's going to be universal, non-means tested, all that sort of stuff. Everyone will have the same amount of money.
Yep.
You'll all get it.
Yep.
But it won't be enough for you to go abroad or anything like that. You'll have to work for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it is an argument that being made is that, you know, with the increasing level of automation and all that sort of stuff, it's going to be inevitable.
Mm.
And I do think that there's probably an argument there that...
This result today with Trump, the Brexit result, and the Pauline Hanson vote in the last election, they all point to this same thing of the disenfranchised saying, hey, not happy with the status quo and the direction this is happening, lashing out and saying, got to do something. I'm not happy with what that's happening. So... So that's understandable. So I think we've really got.
It is understandable. We'll have to wait and see with Donald Trump as to whether or not he's going to be the megalomaniac he was portrayed to be. But
yeah. What those people really needed was a Bernie Sanders. I mean,
exactly. Had Bernie Sanders been the Democratic nominee, he would have won. He would have won comfortably.
Well, I don't know about that. You see,
he would have won comfortably
because there's this. there's this thing in the United States which is a cultural thing of hating government as Big Brother. I mean, this is the country, Scott, where poor people voted against Obamacare. You've got to remember that at all times.
Yeah, that's true.
The very people who Obamacare was designed to help said, oh, I'm not having big government interfere in my health.
In my health care, so I'm going to die instead, yeah.
Yes. So unfortunately, the rational argument didn't work with that, and it wouldn't have worked with Bernie Sanders either, unfortunately, because the education isn't there.
You had to look at... Bernie Sanders was doing very well in the primaries and all that sort of stuff. Mm. He should not have won, but he should not have done as well as he did, but he did, and he fought right until the final primary.
Yeah.
And only then did he concede defeat. And I still to this day maintain that he would have won comfortably against Trump.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll never know that.
Yeah. The irony is that the disenfranchised redneck class that I've been talking about voted for Trump. They really would have needed a Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders.
There's no way they would have voted for a Bernie Sanders. Absolutely no way. Because he's a communist.
Yeah, I know. They call him a communist because he spent his honeymoon over in the Soviet Union.
Mm.
And he is a socialist. There's no point arguing with that. But if Bernie Sanders is a socialist, then every single Australian, from Corey Bernardi through to Bill Shorten, are socialists, you know?
Yeah.
Because we all want universal healthcare, we all want universal education, but... You know, it really is crazy that people weren't going to vote that. But anyway.
Yeah, that's a bit of an American cultural thing. But anyway, Scott, when we first started this podcast, Tony Abbott was in power.
He was, yes.
And we referred to him as the gift that just kept on giving. And I think we've just been handed...
A new gift that's going to keep on giving.
A gift that's going to keep on giving for at least 4 years.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, we'll have to wait and see how long he lasts, but I'd say he'll be there for 4 years. Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Like, had that election been held tomorrow or something, I would have been telling you an article by on our Facebook page, which was saying that basically a Trump victory was mathematically impossible because of what he had to do. And I would have been telling everybody, don't worry, because according to this article...
And that was my position too, through this morning when the better half sent me a text. He says, Trump's going to win. And I said, no, he's not. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine.
Mm.
And then I went on. Then I went online and that sort of stuff about lunchtime. And I looked at it and I thought, holy hell, he might be right. You know, he might win. He might win.
Yeah. But, I found another article. I didn't tell you about this one, I don't think. Christina Keneally.
Our favourite Catholic, yes.
Yeah, former New South Wales Premier. And she wrote a bit of a thing about US elections. And interesting, Scott, we've all been looking at the map today of America with the, the Republican and the Democrats. And it's just confusing for us because... Republicans, being conservative, are shown as red. And we just typically associate left-wing socialism as the red colour.
Yeah.
And it's the opposite over there. Don't know why.
Mm.
People voting on a Tuesday, Scott. Do you know why they vote on a Tuesday?
It's got something to do with when elections first set up, there was horse and carts, and it was set up so that you could go to church on Sunday... And then on Monday you did something in the market, and then on Tuesday, and you were still around there for Tuesday to vote, is my understanding.
Pretty much correct. Was just you needed the travelling time. So in olden days, just horse and cart, and to get to the polling booth. So you couldn't be expected to vote on a Sunday because you needed to go to church. And so, Monday was the travelling day, and you would therefore arrive at the polling booth on Tuesday to cast your vote. So, so we can blame religion for the vote being on a Tuesday. And I mean, how inconvenient for people. I mean, there's some states you cannot pre-poll, so you have to do it on a Tuesday. I mean, you've got a job working at McDonald's for $7.50 an hour. You need every dollar you can get. And mm-hmm. the queues at some polling booths are 6, 7, 8 hours long. What a system.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
while you're there...
Yeah, and those queues that are 6 or 7, 8 hours long are in the poor neighbourhoods and all that sort of stuff. Yes. So they are... The whole thing is stacked against the Democrats, for sure.
Yeah. While you're there in the polling booth, you will also be voting for Senate and House of Reps and some state legislatures, perhaps a governor, perhaps some judges, even county officials such as coroners and dog catchers. You might be voting for some state laws, should the state legalise marijuana. And some local tax levies, like all sorts of stuff, gets bundled up in this election day that's possible that you could be voting on as a voter in America on a Tuesday. So, so yeah, that was that. And did you know that US territories get to vote in the primaries but not the general election? So people in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands don't get to vote on election day.
Yeah. I did not know that.
And the inauguration will be on the 20th of January 2017. So we've got Barack Obama for a little while.
Yeah, and he's in that lame duck period and that sort of stuff. So we'll see how much he gets done during the lame duck period.
It's probably one of those periods where you're not supposed to do anything, Scott. A bit like caretaker periods, you know, when a government calls an election. Like, I don't know, really? Yeah, I mean, might be perfectly legitimate to, for example, pardon some prisoners or people like that. But, you know, in this sort of period, it's probably not the done thing to actually pass substantive laws, given...
It's probably not the done thing to pass substantive laws, but that has been, you know, the pardons and that sort of stuff that... The potentially unpopular ones are always done on the last day.
Right.
You know, you know, that's right. when they pardon all their mates and that sort of stuff. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Scott, quick quiz.
Yes.
From the Essential Report, they polled Australian voters and said, if you had a vote in the US presidential election, would you vote for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Scott, what do you reckon the overall response from Australians would have been on that question?
Yes, probably 60% said they'd vote for Hillary, and the balance would be voting for Donald Trump.
Not bad. 59% for Hillary, 19% for Donald Trump, and 22% for don't knows.
Okay.
So just looking at the Donald Trump voters... People who currently vote Labor, only 14% would have gone for Donald. People who currently vote Liberal National, 27% would have voted for Donald Trump. And the same with the others, which would be your Catter and your Pauline Hanson. 29% of them would have voted for Donald Trump. Which... Prior to today, I would have said to you, it was an extraordinarily high figure, but perhaps not so surprising at the end of the day. But, you know, there you go.
Well, you know, one of the first people to tweet her congratulations was Pauline Hanson.
Yes.
You know, she tweeted to him and said congratulations and that sort of stuff. This was even before it was declared.
Yeah. So there we go. Well, she'd be happy because it just shows the strength of the redneck vote if you can tap into
exactly.
it, which she obviously can. So that's enough for Donald Trump. We'll have plenty of time to talk about him over the next 4 years, for goodness sake. Scott, in Australia, we had the situation of the QUT case came out and was resolved.
Yes.
And
was finally resolved, yes.
We'll talk about that.
So, yeah, it was resolved in the affirmative, wasn't it?
Go. Background, dear listener, some students were at QUT, stumbled across a computer lab and said, oh, can we use these computers? And there was an Aboriginal lady there who said, well, are you guys Aboriginal? And I said, no. And so she said, well, you can't use it. It's reserved for Aboriginals. And they left and then subsequently made some fairly mild comments on Facebook pages. One of them was asking something about, you know, hoping something someone could point out to him where the white supremacists should find their computer lab. So anyway, they were taken to the Human Rights Commission under a complaint by that lady, and then they were subsequently taken to court as well. Court case came out and found that they had no case to answer, but they've been through the ringer, those guys, and
3 years the whole thing's been running for.
So very early days of this podcast, Scott, we were saying that 18C was much too wide, that it makes it an offence to offend and insult people, and we said, well, that's should be allowed. Nothing wrong with that. It's where you're going to incite violence against people that we'll draw the line. But and at that time, neither party was interested in changing the law. And now it seems that at least the Liberal Party is going to change the law because they reckon it's too wide. So that's something. And even Gillian Triggs has now come out and said it's probably too wide and should get rid of the offend and insult parts of Section 18C.
Well, that's a very good move on her part, yeah. It's I would have thought she'd be right up there, but apparently not.
So she's happy. Well, she's said something that she'd like to see those. She'd be okay with those being removed. So Scott, I have a bit of sympathy for Triggs and the Human Rights Commission because they say they previously wanted the threshold raised so that they didn't have to deal with frivolous complaints, that the government declined to help them out, so they were stuck with this. But when the complaint was made, they didn't inform those students. They informed QUT and left it up to QUT to inform the students. So the students didn't know for a long time and were only told 3 days before a hearing that they were in strife, so they certainly fell down in that area.
They certainly did, and that was one of the things that I was really crook about, was that they didn't have any idea that this was going on, and this is despite the fact that the whole thing had been running for 3 years, and the poor buggers found out 3 days before the hearing was up. So, you know, they got represented pro bono, I believe.
They did, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I don't know who was the one that, I don't know who the solicitor was that put his hand up to represent them, but
I think Tony Morris QC was the QC, so good on him for that.
Okay.
I think I went to uni with the lawyer for the Aboriginal woman. Yes. And let's just say I'm not surprised by the action that was taken by the It's all in character from what I observed in some tutorials, put it that way. So no surprise there. Okay, so that was 18C. And Scott, normally, dear listener, if you're listening to us for the first time, we're normally fairly Australian-focused, but hey, the US election, that's a big one. And also, this Brexit thing, this is a big one as well. Like, they've had a referendum, come out with a decision to exit, and just in the last week, a court has made a ruling that that it's not up to the Prime Minister and Cabinet now to withdraw from the treaty, that in fact it must go through Parliament for a Parliament decision to withdraw from the treaty. And that could be a problem, Scott, maybe.
Could well be a problem because you've got majority of the parliamentarians were on the side of remaining, and
yeah,
how many of them are going to turn their back on their long held beliefs and say, well, you know, my electorate voted for Brexit, therefore I'm going to vote for Brexit in the Parliament. You know, that's what they're going to be faced with. I don't know whether or not there's going to be a number of them that would turn their back on their electorates, though. I mean, you'd have to be pretty convinced that it was an outlier decision to turn your back on your electorate and vote against the electorate. You know, it's...
I mean, it was a pretty close vote. So
it was a very close vote.
There must have been nearly half of the electorates who voted to stay. So those politicians might well feel compelled to vote to stay. And then it might only therefore need a handful of politicians whose electorate said leave who decide, bugger them, we're just going to stay anyway. Like, it mightn't need that many politicians to go against the preference of their electorate. So
yeah, it is very interesting. I mean, you look at the way the vote changed, and the vote was very much Remain in London and those sorts of places. As you get further out from London, as you go further north and that sort of stuff, it was Leave. Then you go to Scotland, where it was Stay. And then you go to Wales, where it was Leave. It was a real sort of patchwork of Leave versus Stay.
Yes.
I would be surprised if you've... I would still be surprised if you got a majority of... If you got a majority of the people who were elected turning their back on their electorates, though. But stranger things have happened.
Yeah, as
and you know, it could well be that the referendum was a complete waste of money. Yeah,
could well be. Yeah.
I mean, I've often thought, and I've said this from day one, was that they should wait and see what terms Europe offers them to leave, and then Theresa May could go to the electorate and say, "This is what you are now voting for. This is what Brexit looks like. Do you want to stay or do you want to go?" You know, and they could have a follow-up referendum. And it, depending on how harsh the terms are put on by Brussels, it may well get a different result.
Anyway, from a technical point of view, it's quite interesting that the Prime Minister and Cabinet were relying on a power which is called the Royal Prerogative. So when there was the initial dividing up of powers, when the monarchy was losing its power, the monarchy retained for some time what was called the Royal Prerogative. And this was powers in relation to the conduct of international relations and the makings of treaties. Falls within that prerogative. So that was initially retained by the king or queen. And then as time went on, that royal prerogative transferred to the prime minister and the cabinet. So the so what they've said in England, the prime minister and the cabinet, was, well, we've had a decision from the people and we don't need to pass a bill through Parliament. We can just do it as part of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And the court said, no, here's the problem. When you signed up for the EU, you did through an Act of Parliament. So if you want to get out of the EU, you've got to do so through an Act of Parliament. Had you entered the EU as part of Royal Prerogative Powers, maybe you could get out as part of Royal Prerogative Powers. But because you entered using an Act of Parliament, you've got to exit using an Act of Parliament, which seems a pretty good argument to me. So, the Royal Prerogative... makings of treaties, declaration of war, Scott, recognition of foreign states, accreditation of diplomats. That's the sort of thing that you can do as part of a royal prerogative. And we had a discussion ages ago about Australia. And as a matter of constitutional law, apparently Section 61 of our constitution says that those normal prerogative powers reside in our Australian Prime Minister and Cabinet. So, same things apply here. And that explains, Scott, why we are in the crazy position about how easy it is for a Prime Minister to declare war and how difficult it is to do other things. So, dear listener, if you think about it, we're in a situation now where the Prime Minister wanted a plebiscite on gay marriage and he could not get it through Parliament. So he can't even get a plebiscite up and running in this country. But he could declare war on anybody at any time, just with the stroke of a pen.
Yeah, it is crazy. I do think that the military action thing has to be handed over to Parliament.
We've got to do something. We've got to make some legislation. Sure, if there's missiles flying through the air heading this way, the Prime Minister can act swiftly without referring it to Parliament. But for it hasn't happened in recent, at any time. Any of the wars that we've entered into could easily have gone through Parliament, the decision-making, and it's absurd that we are letting the power to conduct that sort of thing stay in the hands of Prime Minister and Cabinet. Should be removed.
Yeah, exactly.
The royal prerogative should be handed back to Parliament, I think, that power. Mm. So there we go. I've got an article here. Regular listeners would know I've got a big thing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We have briefly discussed it. There's an article here which talks about Canada and the problems they've had with NAFTA. And it's a disaster for a country to enter into a trade agreement with clauses that allow companies to sue the countries involved. But given what's happened in the US, I reckon that's been superseded because the TPP is dead in the water, I think, Scott. So I'm just
We'll go back to what I said originally. Mm. It depends whether or not Obama can get it through in his lame duck period.
Mm.
It's unlikely.
Yeah. Scott, you hear the
but,
music.
You know, I mean, the main problem with the TPP was the ISDS. You know, that is the main problem with it, is that you've got this situation that, you know, an ISDS, listeners, is the situation where you go in, you don't go to court or anything like that. It's conducted between lawyers. And I forget where the numbers were, but they were quite chilling on that, in that...
The classic case, dear listener, is the tobacco packaging, where Australia decided we were going to have plain packaging tobacco, and tobacco companies, multinational ones, sued the Australian government, saying that that was a breach of a fair trade agreement that we had. So... Mm. In Canada, they're suffering because they have banned certain chemicals which are harmful to people and the environment, and the companies that produce those chemicals are suing the Canadian government saying, we can't do that, that's a breach of our fair trade. Same with fracking, like companies that are involved with fracking. When Canada decided to ban fracking in certain parts, these multinational companies are suing Canada for damages. So it's those sorts of decisions. And they're just increasing for poor old Canada.
Yeah, and you got it here. Canada has lost or settled a startling 62.7% of these cases brought against it. Mm. You know, that's a hell of a lot that you can lose. And it makes you wonder whether or not the, you know, how their whole set up, you know.
Mm.
Anyway.
Scott, did you hear that Amazon is coming to Australia?
Are they?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
They're setting up a warehouse, and they're setting up a facility here, and they're going to be trading out of Australia.
Okay.
Wonder if they'll ever pay any tax.
Probably not.
Based on the example of Apple and other companies of their like, see, this, Scott, is where we should be saying to Amazon, don't bother.
Pay something.
Yeah. What do you reckon your turnover is going to be? Okay, X percent is going into a trust fund, and... Mm. We want to see some tax paid at the end of the day. And, we don't need them. They need us. We're quite happy how we are. And there's a real risk that they will come in and wipe out a whole bunch of Australian businesses who are currently paying tax.
Mm-hmm.
And they will do a deal with some Singapore subsidiary where they will pay a royalty fee and effectively pay no tax in Australia because they'll artificially lower their so-called profits. So
yeah, exactly.
We shouldn't let them in until we know we can get some tax out of them.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you there. You know, it's Apple and Google have already shown us the way there. You know, it's crazy that you've got companies over here that are operating, they're making a fortune, and they're not paying any bloody tax.
Got an article here about, well, I call them crazy South Koreans, but they're probably not that crazy. This is a change of pace, dear listener. In South Korea, After an instructional lecture and video, participants in this activity are led into a dimly lit hall decorated with chrysanthemums, where they sit, often tearfully, beside a coffin, and they write their last testament. They put on burial shrouds and then lie in the coffins. And a grim man dressed in a black robe, called the Envoy from the Other World, hammers the lids closed on their coffins, and they're left encased in the coffin for 10 minutes. And then they let them out. But it's a program designed to make people think about life. And when I first read it, I thought, those crazy South Koreans and what they're up to. But actually, I think it's a good idea. Like, very positive reviews from the participants. And some participants had terminal illnesses and wanted help preparing for the end. Others had suicidal impulses that they wanted to dispel, and businesses were using it as a motivational program. So people feel like they've got a bit of a fresh start and a new lease of life. So would you do that, Scott?
Probably not, no.
I think
I can understand. After I read it, I could understand why people were invited, why people got involved with it.
Mm.
But it's not really my thing. But, I wouldn't judge anyone that did do it, you know.
I think if you got into it, the spirit of it, it could be quite enlightening and liberating. And at the end of it, you would go, wow. You know, you don't often think about your life and value it in the day-to-day, you know, treadmill running that we all do.
That's true. Like, you're running from pillar to post and that sort of stuff, so you don't sit there and think about what life is. Mm. But, it probably does make a point.
If somebody started that up in Australia, I think I might give it a crack. So, it sort of reminds me of the Nobel Peace Prize sort of idea. Do you know why Nobel started the Peace Prize?
No, I don't.
Okay, so he was an industrialist who was famous for either inventing dynamite, or he made all of his money from dynamite, Nobel. And he was inaccurately, his death was reported. So he got to read his own obituary. And he read the obituary, which basically said, you know, Nobel, very wealthy man, made his money from dynamite, X number of kids, X millions of dollars, the end. And he thought, is that it? Is that all they could write about me? Is that the only mark I've left on the world? And so then he decided to start the Nobel Peace Prize and donate the money. And the prize is named after him, and his name has continued on evermore as a result. Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, makes sense, yeah.
Scott, one of the issues we have in this world is the left, the regressive left, is not addressing the problems that we have with Islam. They're not allowing any criticism of Islam. So that's just leaving it up to the hard right elements of the world. So if you've got a real genuine problem with Islam and what Islam is up to, your only recourse is to vote for hard right people.
Pauline Hanson,
Donald Trump. Because the left is just refusing to acknowledge that there is any issue at all. And that is exemplified very much by news about... there's a group in America called the... The Southern
Poverty Law Center.
Quite a big organization. And they've come out and made a list of 15 anti-Muslim extremists who they believe are represented too often in mainstream media, and criticizing the extremists for spreading baseless and damaging lies in order to demonize all Muslims. And the problem is, Scott, that two of the people listed on that 15, one is Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and the other one is Majid Nawaz.
Yeah.
You could not get more reasonable thought-provoking, honest brokers of an argument that we have a problem here, let's address it and speak about it rationally. It's just appalling that those two people would be put on such a list.
It really, it beggars belief that they've been put on that list. Mm. It makes me wonder whether or not the Southern Poverty Law Center didn't do their due diligence or something like that, because it really is astounding that they decided that these two were anti-Muslim. You know, how do you say his name?
Majid Nawaz.
Yeah, Majid Nawaz. Mm. He's not anti-Muslim. He's still a practicing Muslim himself. He wants to reform the way Islam is worshipped and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
And then, you know, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, yes, she's anti... No, she's not anti-Muslim. She is anti-Islam.
Mm.
And she has come out and said some stuff that has been taken as provocative by Islamic clerics.
Because they disagree with her. But she said it exactly. In a very appropriate manner. So
exactly. Yeah. You know, and, you know, she's also not the one, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center isn't providing her with bodyguards, you know, but she has to have armed bodyguards with her, you know, which I find incredible that, you know, that she has adopted this position that's got her so many death threats that she has to have a bodyguard with her, you know. I find that incredible. I was really disappointed, when, you know, because I heard about this initially on another podcast that I listened to. And I thought to myself, that's not right. You know, this isn't right. And then you sent me this link, and I thought to myself, bloody hell, that's really wrong.
Mm.
You know, that they have done this. And, you know, when you actually go through it all and that sort of stuff, and you sit down there and you read it all, you think to yourself, you know, these guys are relying on gossip and that sort of stuff to make their case. And aside from anything else, they have labelled the two of them as bigots when they're not bigots, and they've done the work for the imams themselves. The imams have come out and said these two are blasphemous and that sort of stuff, and they should be ignored and, you know, killed and that sort of thing. When it's not... The Southern Poverty Law Center has come out and basically backed up the imams, which I find really reprehensible. And, you know, Islam is just a religion, that's for sure, but it has got some quirky followers in it that are really nasty types. And they are following a perverse, maybe it's a perverse form of the code, but it is still the religion.
Yep. So this is the problem, that the left is just refusing to allow any criticism of Islam, and therefore those who have legitimate problems with Islam are left with some fairly ratbaggish right-wing elements as the only options they have if they want policies that are going to deal with it in some way. So
yeah, exactly.
Hopefully down the track, Scott, in the secular party, we can get out the message that we're not right-wing nutbags, but we do have legitimate issues with Islam and legitimate criticisms to make. And so people who can't vote green because of their refusal to engage on this issue might look at our policies and go, well, actually, everything else they do is reasonable, and they're prepared to talk about Islam in a critical way. So we might pick up some that way, which could be good.
Well, we might pick up some people, yeah, for sure.
Well, Scott, I said to my wife, this thing about Donald Trump, I'm going to have a podcast that I might go over time, and she absolutely tore strips off me if I was to go over time. and she said, well, you'll just have to do it for next week. So, Scott, you know, I sent you about, I've still got a bunch of papers here. We've got a lot of topics to go through, but we've come up to the hour.
We have come up to the hour, which is a pity. But anyway, we'll hold over becoming a guardian of SRE till next week.
Yeah, we'll do that next week. So, dear listener, thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for listening in.
Yes. While we're both members of the Secular Party, views expressed, not necessarily those of the Secular Party. For full details, check out the website of the Secular Party. If you have looked at the events in the USA and you've thought to yourself, what a nightmare. Gosh, I hope this never happens in Australia. Then what you need to do is to go onto the Secular Party website and join, because we need members, and you'll never forgive yourself if you just sit back and do nothing and we end up with the sort of characters that they have in the United States running the country. So so there's your warning and your chance, your opportunity, and sign up. We need more people. And there'll be a video released during the week. We'll put that on the Facebook page, a link as well, so you'll see my mug as I extol the virtues of the Secular Party. So look out for that. And until next time, we will catch you then. Bye for now.
Bye now. Thank you.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.